Okay, yesterday we started part of the way through chapter 4, and there was those really critical verses where Paul cites Genesis 15:6 and uses that as the basis for his argument that something other than rule-keeping behavior was involved. And of course, the long discussion that we had was the difference between the church's view of the separation of law and grace and Paul's view of the relationship between righteousness, DK and law. Okay? And so what I want to do is, I thought about this all night, of course. This is one of those things where you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, hey, I should have said more about this. So I wrote some stuff. So I'm going to read you the things that I wrote about those particular verses. Romans 4:4 and or 4:3 and Genesis 15:6, because I want to make really, really clear what Paul is actually doing in comparison to how the church has read these verses, so that we won't have any mistakes going forward when Paul now builds on that argument. Okay, so here's what I wrote. You're going to see this in today's Word eventually. Okay, as you know, Paul cites this verse, Genesis 15:6. Then he believed in the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness, right? In order to justify his claim that Abraham was not considered righteous due to his own efforts, but rather by the free act of God. He uses this citation in Romans 4 just before he launches into a discussion of circumcision. The Christian church has always taken this verse to mean that works are not the basis of salvation. Since Luther and the Reformation, Paul's citation of this verse has been used to argue that grace and works are polar opposites. In fact, Luther used this passage as justification for his idea of alien righteousness, which we talked about, that is, righteousness that has nothing whatsoever to do with any human efforts. Calvin justified his doctrine of irresistible grace and unconditional election based on exactly the same idea, that we don't have anything to do with it. God chooses, and that's the end of the story. But what, in fact, is Paul actually saying? To better understand, we went back to this verse in Hebrew, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about that, right? Through the lens of Paul as a Jewish Orthodox Messianic believer, we discover that we have to understand what's happening in the Genesis passage in Hebrew in order to understand how Paul applies it, okay? So in this little document that you'll see later, I give you the Hebrew text. And then I say, the first word is the conjugated verb aman with the vav prefix. This is a hifel perfect. Okay? Now I want to make a big point to that. I know we talked about it yesterday, but I'm going to make it again because this is really, really important. That means it is a completed action, perfect, that expresses a causative aspect. Hifel verbs bring something about. They begin something. And I quote from a source here. The hefel stem is generally used to express causative action in active voice. In many cases, the noun derived from the same root is the object or result of the hefel verb associated with that root. For example, the hefel verb for rain means to cause to rain down, and the noun means rain. The perfect tense means this causative action is finished. So what do we learn, right? Here's the verse. And he believed. And now that word, believed, is a causative, hefel, perfect verb, which means the action is finished and it made something happen, okay? Does this verbal form of Abraham's trust, because that's what aman really means, trust, did it bring about God's response? And if that is not the case, then does it imply that Abraham's trust was caused by something else, which is what we talked about, like the example, caused the rain to fall? We have two possible scenarios. The first is that all of Abraham's prior experience with God caused him to trust, and that's what we talked about yesterday. This makes the verb a passive, that is, it reflects upon the subject. It's something done to the subject, not something the subject does. This is possible because we have many stories of God's faithfulness to Abraham before we come to this verse. But there's another possibility, and this is what we didn't talk about yesterday, right? The hefel verb could suggest that Abraham's trust causes the ensuing judgment by God. If this is the case, then it isn't correct to say that Abraham did nothing, as Luther would suggest. Abraham might not have fulfilled any of the specific physical commandments of orthodoxy, but he did what is the basis of fulfilling all the commandments. He trusted God. And that choice, that willingness, caused God to make a decision about Abraham. You see, it's causative. What Abraham does causes something else to happen, right? That is, God decides to consider him tzedekah, righteous. Had Luther paid attention to the Hefel form, he would have seen that Abraham was not the recipient of alien righteousness, but rather that Abraham's trust was a deliberate act that caused a change in his status before God. Abraham's act caused God's decision. God's choice is not divorced from human decision, but rather is brought about by human decision. Abraham opted to follow God, and God considered that as sufficient proof of meeting the expected norm, which is what tzedekah means. Obedience and grace go hand in hand. Okay? That's the first part. The second part is about the verb credited, because in Greek we have, then he believed in the Lord and he credited, and he, God, credited it to him as righteousness. Okay, so here's what we know so far. Believed is a hifel causative perfect. That means the action is finished, and whatever it does, it makes something else happen. Okay? And we know from previous discussion that tzedekah, righteousness, means conformity to an expected norm. Right? Now we want to know what the verb for credited is, because, okay, so I say the following. When you look at the NASB, you see a little footnote with the word credited. When you see that footnote before the word credited, in the margin of the NASB, you'll find, or imputed. So here is Luther, imputed righteousness, alien righteousness, right? Now, that's a problem. Why? Because the word imputed, like the word credited, strongly suggests some sort of divine accounting, a tally sheet that gives us a score about Abraham. Accordingly, the Christian church suggests that God gave Abraham credit on his heavenly balance sheet so that he was acceptable to God without Abraham doing anything. That is, without erga, which is the word that Paul uses. It's the Greek word for works. Okay? So remember, the church makes a big distinction between works and grace. Works and righteousness, okay? So we're going to see if that verse, if this verse supports that idea, okay? But what we've learned is that the hifel form of the verb aman in Genesis suggests that Abraham did do something. He trusted, and his trust caused God to respond. Of course, Abraham didn't do erga, that is, he didn't perform any religious acts with the intention of gaining divine approval. In fact, in Paul's day, we mentioned this yesterday, the Greek term erga, when applied to human beings, was considered sinful. Everything called ergon in human life is sin when measured by the final criteria. That's from the Septuagint, right? Thus, erga, as a human works, along with the verb, are often linked to wickedness. Paul isn't making a Greek mistake. That's why he refers to the Hebrew verse in Genesis. He wants his Greek-speaking audience to know that Abraham didn't do something in order to gain favor with God. Rather, Abraham trusted God, and that trust initiated a response from God which resulted in God's consideration of Abraham. If we were to put this in modern Jewish terms, we'd look to a statement by Heschel. Quote, "The purpose of prayer is to be brought to his attention, to be listened to be understood by him. Not to know him, but to be known by him. Abraham's trust gains God's attention. No religious ritual or fulfilled commandment is involved. There's no erga. But that does not mean that Abraham is the passive recipient of divine election. What is it that God does when he pays attention to Abraham? The Hebrew verb is, hold on, the Hebrew verb is hasav. Here in a vav consecutive plus the imperfect. Okay, what does that tell you? Well, we'll look at the vav consecutive in a second. But if it's in the imperfect, it means an action that isn't completed. Okay? So the action of Abraham is completed. Right? Remember, it was a hifel perfect. Abraham caused something, and that was a one-time finished event. But God's response to it is not a finished event. It's an imperfect. Okay? The form is important. You'll recall, hopefully, that a vav consecutive is like translating the verb in the past, present, and future all at once. You will also recall that the imperfect form means that the action is not finished. In other words, on the basis of Abraham's trust, God views Abraham continuously, past, present, and future, unfinished, as righteous, tzedekah. And tzedekah means in conformity to an expected standard. So as a result of Abraham's trust, which is a finished causative action, God responds in a continuous, not finished, status that he views Abraham as someone whose act of faithfulness, his act of trust, initiates his status before God so that God pays attention to him and recognizes him as fulfilling the basic principle of obedience, right? Which is trust. So God views Abraham as having been aligned, and willing to be aligned with his purposes, right? God's view of Abraham places Abraham in complete relationship now and forever. Abraham's trust initiates God's response to view Abraham as a model of God's own character, right? Righteous. In the end, tzedakah is about what it means to be like God, to be human. And now here's the quote. Tzedakah is used attributively when applied to God himself as to his character. The Lord is the just judge, even to the utmost degree as a judge of all the earth. Therefore, his standards, his judgments, set out in the word, are righteous. Being everlasting, they are the confidence of his people and will not fail. God's hate of sin and love of righteousness expresses essential righteousness. Therefore, righteousness and judgment are the habitation of God's throne. They are always characteristic of his actions. So, when it says that Abraham's Hifel present trust initiated God's continuous, imperfect response that made Abraham righteous, he's saying that God considered Abraham's trust the basis for recognizing a conformity to the standards of God's purposes from that point on, or also added to the past actions of Abraham. Okay? In other words, what God said is, Abraham, you're like me. It's as simple as that, right? Because God is righteous, and his righteousness lasts forever and has always been. When God says to Abraham, your action of trusting me means that I can treat you just like me, okay? Abraham qualifies. Paul's Greek version of this verse uses the term logizomai, to be credited. But the accounting nuance is only part of the umbrella of the meanings. The verb also means to deliberate, to conclude. Quote, in the Septuagint, it takes on the nuance of an emotional and even volitional act, devising or counting in the subjective sense, not objective. Okay? Paul uses Greek like a Jew, and in this case, credited is more Western than Jewish. From the Hebrew text, we should probably translate this verse, and God concluded that Abraham was righteous. That is, that Abraham had God's character. Okay? Or something similar. It's not divine accounting. It's an emotional and volitional act, as the Septuagint suggests. Finally, Paul's Greek term for righteousness is dikaiosune. And from the Greek grouping, dike, the word fits the Hebrew tzedakah, since it also means conforming to custom, fulfilling obligations, and observing legal norms. Right? Dike is about law in all of its forms. It is the Greek equivalent of Torah. When God concludes that Abraham's trust means Abraham's character models God's character, God recognizes that Abraham fulfills the primary condition of Torah obedience, willingness. Paul is not suggesting that law and grace stand in opposition to each other. He is in fact saying that law and grace are mutually inclusive, and the case of Abraham proves it. Okay? So there you go.
Skip.
Okay. Yes.
So.
Yes. Comments?
Yes, this is Maddie. I just want to ask, so I understand the Abraham side. I just want to clarify when you say that God caused something. That does not mean.
That God what? I'm sorry, Maddie, I didn't hear you.
That God caused something to happen.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that Abraham's act of trust causes God's response. So it's not true that Abraham does nothing. Abraham doesn't do any of the ritual religious commandment obligations, which is true. No. Paul says that didn't happen, right? But Abraham does what is absolutely essential to all of those. He trusts God. And his trust is what causes God to, in Heschel's terms, pay attention to him. And when God pays attention to him, what does he see? A man who is after his own heart. In other words, Abraham's character is like God's character, and that's the basis of righteousness, because righteousness is conformity to a standard. So Abraham actually does conform to the standard, even though he doesn't do any ritual religious acts. Do you understand?
Yes, I understand Abraham's side, but if I go first to that, in order for Abraham to trust God, God was the first one that did something so that Abraham can trust. That could Calvin come in there and say, well, see, it was God who chose Abraham.
Yes, it is God who chooses Abraham, but Abraham has to respond. So Lech Lecha, God called Abraham to come out, right? Abraham has to respond to that. And the history of Abraham's responding to God is God causing Abraham and Abraham causing God. It's a mutual involvement, right? But in this verse, since Abraham already has the experience with God of leaving, fulfilling the obligation, et cetera, right? In this verse, this is just before circumcision, which is why Paul chooses it. In this verse, it's Abraham's trust that causes God to say, oh my gosh, this man has the same character as me, and therefore I'm going to treat him that way. Right?
Okay.
Does that make sense to you, Maddie?
Yes, it does. I was just like, yesterday when we spoke, I thought, well, I can see Calvinism coming in there and saying, see, God chose Abraham, God caused Abraham, so now, you know, and to me, that's a bad theology too.
Yeah, sure, because Calvin and Luther look at this verse and they say, you see, Paul is saying that Abraham's faith had nothing to do with works. And so in their mind, law stands in opposition to grace. So works have to be excluded because Abraham was credited righteousness before any works were done. But that's to misunderstand the Hebrew, because in the Hebrew, it surely shows that Abraham's trust is a causative action, right? It's not only that God provides previous experience so that Abraham has a reason to trust, right, which is on God's side, but Abraham also chooses to trust, and that's a causative action. So it's not true that God simply elects Abraham for no reason whatsoever. As the Calvinism would say, unconditional election. God chooses, you don't know why, and whoever he chooses, those are the people that get saved. Okay? Calvin would base that on this verse, reading the verse as though Abraham did nothing and God just chose him. Okay? But we know from the Hebrew that Abraham did something. He might have done it in relation to previous experiences where God was initiating the experience, but in this verse, Abraham has to make a decision. And the decision that he makes reflects the character of God, and God treats him accordingly. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is really, really important, because the next step in Paul's argument is the issue about the symbolic significance of circumcision, right? So if we don't get this point, then we're going to end up with the whole idea that the church rejects circumcision as having any value at all, because after all, faith came before circumcision, right? Which is what Paul's going to argue, but he's not arguing that it came before anything that mattered at all, because the Hifel Perfect shows that that Abraham's choice was the basis for God's action. Okay, Tim, you had something to say?
Doesn't it all come just down to how they're defining the word works? what you said yesterday.
I didn't hear you. You're going to have to.
Doesn't it come down?
I can't hear you.
Doesn't it come down to the fact that how they're defining the word works, like you said yesterday?
Yeah, of course. Yes, of course. And we pointed out that in the Septuagint, the word that Paul uses, ergon, from erga, right, is a word that the Septuagint views as essentially sinful. That is, efforts that I do on my behalf in order to gain divine favor. Okay? And the rabbinic view of that is anything that I do when I intend to benefit from it, from, you know, in other words, I'm going to obligate God to do something because I'm doing the right thing for, you know, for me, and I'm doing it in accordance with God's plan, therefore he's obligated to do it. Any of that kind of idea obviously has built into it pride and self-inflation, and the rabbis say no. If you use the Greek term erga in that sense, it's always wrong. Right? That's not how God responds. Okay? In other words, I can't make God do something. Why is that important? Because God's choice of treating Abraham as a model of God's own behavior is still a choice. Right? It doesn't come about because God is obligated to do that on the behalf of Abraham. It comes about because God is willing to do it. Okay? So now we need to move on into four. Oh, and by the way, just so that, So we're going to get to verse 13 and then we're going to have to look at this all over again because of the way that the word nomos is translated. Okay. So let's continue. Okay. So we've established what Abraham is, what the relationship between God and Abraham is. And we've established that Paul wants to use the Hebrew idea as justification for his argument. And then he says, we talked about this yesterday. How then was this relationship established? While he was circumcised or while he was uncircumcised? When he was uncircumcised. Does that matter? It only matters to rule-keeping religion. It doesn't matter in terms of what was happening in the Genesis text because Abraham's decision to trust is the foundation for all Torah obedience, right? I don't obey Torah in order to get something, as though I just have to, you know, if I do X, Y, and Z, then God will have to give me something. That's not what's going on. What's happening in the Genesis account is that Abraham is acting in the same way that God's character is expressed. And as I pointed out, Abraham is being human according to God's idea of what it means to be human. And that's the foundation for all the rest of the obedience. So it comes before that, right? So circumcision is the symbolic representation of this willingness. And that's what Paul wants to bank on, because he says, and then his argument is, wait a minute, the Gentiles who by their own nature make decisions like Abraham are just as worthy of God's attention than Abraham, right? Because Abraham wasn't circumcised yet, so obviously the action that causes God to pay attention to Abraham happens before circumcision. So the same thing can happen with the Gentile population. If they turn toward God in an act of trust, God pays attention to them, just as he did to Abraham. No difference. Okay? So he says, as we go on, the father of circumcision, this is in 12, and the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, right? They've made the choice and they fulfilled the symbolic representation, but also those who, now get this, follow in the steps of our father Abraham. How do you follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham? You make a willing choice to be obedient, even if you don't know what all the Torah requirements are, because you've aligned yourself with the character of God. That's what Paul's arguing. Right? To follow in the steps of the faith of Abraham is to be in the same conscious position that Abraham is when Genesis 15:6 says, and Abraham trusted God. Okay? All right. So to all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be reckoned to them. Same idea. that God will pay attention to them, see their character, recognize himself in that character, and treat them in a way that brings them into relationship with him. Okay? Okay. So now 13, and this is really in a verse. Yes, it's frustrating because I want to get through this stuff faster, but they're just, it's just packed full of stuff. And you, if you go too fast, then you, you know, you miss these things. Okay. But let's look at 13. Here's what it says in my NASB. For the promise to Abraham or to his descendants that they would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. Stop, put the brakes on, and go look at the Greek text. That's where we're going to go first, okay? Because the translation was not through the law is absolutely not correct. Because first, there's no definite article, and second, the word law isn't capitalized. So what really happening in the Greek text is it says it's not through law. And that means Paul is using the word nomos as though it means rule-oriented behavior. He's not talking about Torah. When the English translation capitalizes the word and puts the definite article in front of it, it makes you think that Paul is talking about the law, namely Torah, right? But in Greek, he's not doing that. That's a bad translation of the Greek because in the Greek, it just says by law. It doesn't say by the law, and it certainly doesn't capitalize it. Yes, Lindy.
I was just going to say the translation that I have, which is Stern's, it says, did not come through legalism, not lowercase L, but through righteousness and the trust.
Perfect. Stern got it right. Because Paul is not talking about the Torah. He's talking about this idea of legalism, that if I just do all the rules, God is obligated to serve me.
Okay? Makes more sense.
This is really, really important because you can see that the translation that I have in the NASB is based on a theological doctrine of the church. It's not based on the Greek text. Okay? And that's why I put this link in so that you can go read about the various uses that Paul has of the word nomos. Because every single time in the English translations of the Standard Bible, right? Wherever you find the word nomos, you will find the English translation saying the capital L law, as though Paul is talking about Torah. But there are plenty of times when that doesn't make any sense at all, because nomos is also social convention and political requirement and just the way that the community operates and et cetera, et cetera. And the same word has this huge umbrella of meanings. And if you don't distinguish those meanings, you're going to end up thinking Paul is saying that the law isn't good. The law has nothing to do with faith, right? Which is not what he's saying. Okay, Lindy, you have a comment?
If you take away the translation that I have, you can apply it to how you would be with a friend, children, or whatever, because it says, didn't come through legalism, but through the righteousness that trust produces. So think about, even in your own life.
Yeah.
You know, if you... Yeah. When you do something with someone and you expect and you give them whatever it is and you just trust they do it. And when people do it on a, that doesn't mean they don't screw up, but on a regular basis, you have trust in this other person.
Right.
And it's
okay. So, I love Stern's translation there because look what it says that, through trust that produces righteousness. In other words, trust is a causative factor, which is exactly what the Hillel Perfect says in Genesis. That trust is the cause of righteousness, okay? It's not that God just elected Abraham and decided that he would be, you know, the father of many nations. Abraham had to make choices, and those choices caused God to respond in a certain kind of way. And that's what Paul is getting at here. He's saying, don't you see that a Gentile can make the same kind of choice. A Gentile who is uncircumcised can make exactly the same kind of choice that Abraham made, and God will treat him in the same way. Right? It has nothing to do with Torah observance. It has to do with this principle that legalism, rule-oriented behavior to create obligation, isn't sufficient. Does that mean that we just throw out all the rules? No, because you will see, as we've discovered in Genesis 15:6 passage, that tzedakah, righteousness, means conformity to the standard. What's the standard? God's standard. And how does God's standard get conformed to? By making causative choices, right? Okay? So it's absolutely linked together. Paul is saying, don't you see, Abraham, when he made the choice, initiated an action that God paid attention to. And the Gentiles will do the same thing. And that comes before the actions to adopt the symbolic representation, right? Circumcision. And therefore, the Gentiles have as much right to enter into a relationship with God based on trust as Abraham did. Okay? That's his argument. And now think about the audience he's writing to. The Orthodox Jewish community of Rome would have said, before Paul's argument, you have to be circumcised, you have to make a covenant commitment to Torah, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have all these steps that you have to go through. Baptism was one of them, right? You have to do those in order to belong. And what does Paul say? No, that's not the case. What matters is your willingness to be obedient to God and trusting that God will respond to you. And once that happens, everything else is afterwards. Does it mean that everything else doesn't count? Of course not. Everything else matters. But it doesn't matter as the foundation for what happens. What the foundation begins with the choice to trust and the willingness to enter into this relationship with God. Everything else is the consequence of that. Okay? Are we clear Skip. About that? Because this is Skip. Really, really important, right?
Skip.
Yeah.
On that basis, it looks like Uriel has it wrong in verse 13 then, because he uses the word Torah with a capital T.
And here it is. Ta-da! Yeah, and I was going to talk about that next, because here's what Uriel ben Mordecai. Forgot. Mordecai says, right? He translates 13. Remember, He can't do a translation because in P46 there isn't any Romans chapter 4, so he has to interpolate, okay? And he says the bottom line, the pledge for Abraham and his progeny was not by just way of Torah, his beneficiary was destined to be mankind, but also by way of an uprightness from the trusting attitude. Now, by also and was also by way of an uprightness from trusting attitude, I can buy. Because that's the same as saying the trusting attitude is the foundation upon which God pays attention to Abraham and recognizes the character. Okay? But Uriel translates nomos as Torah. And he shouldn't do that. Because nomos, in this case, doesn't come with a definite article and clearly doesn't mean Torah, because Paul's later going to say Torah is really important. Right? So there, again, every single translator has an agenda, and unfortunately, you got to walk through all this stuff one word at a time to figure out what's really going on there. And it's, quite frankly, complicated, as you've probably figured out by now, right? You have to be very, very careful, because there's so many layers of orthodoxy laid on top of Paul's letter, not just Christian, but also Jewish orthodoxy laid on it, right? So we want to read the letter as best we can from the perspective that Paul provides, which means that we have to know what's going on in Genesis 15:6 in order to understand why Paul writes in the way that he does. Okay? So, if we've made it to verse 13, then we can continue, right? Because now the rest of the argument follows really easily, right? For 14. For if those who are, what? Of the law? Wait a minute. That's a mistranslation of the Greek. It should read, for if those who are living by rules, who are legalists, right? Faith is made void and the promise empty. Why? Because a legalist acts on the basis of what's due, not what's given, right? If I look at it this way. If I keep all the rules, you owe me. It's not a basis of me hoping that you will turn your attention toward me and grant me favor. It's, if I keep all the rules, then I can say to God, hey, I'm sorry, but I kept all the rules. Now you make me healthy, wealthy, and wise. That was, okay, let's back up. There's a story about that. We're going to go back to Genesis. Jacob, right? When Jacob leaves to go to the uncle, right? He's sent away to make sure he doesn't get killed by his brother, right? And he has that dream, remember? He lays his head down on the rocks, and then he says, oh, my gosh, I didn't know God was in this place. And we call it Jacob's ladder, but it was really like an escalator, okay? And God makes Jacob a promise. What's the promise? The promise is, when you return, I'm going to do this and this and this, and you're going to be, you know, rewarded and blessed and all that kind of stuff. And guess what? What does Jacob say? Jacob says, oh, my gosh, that's fantastic, God. I really trust you. No, that's not what Jacob says. What Jacob says is, we'll see, right? I'll go do everything, and then when I come back, we'll see if you do it. In other words, Jacob thinks he's going to earn his way. He's going to go off and do everything he's supposed to, and when he comes back, God is obligated to do all this stuff, which is why, by the way, he has to have the encounter at the Brook Jabbok, and he has to wrestle with his own identity of what he thinks God should do and discover that there's more to it, which is what my book Crossing is about. If you haven't read Crossing, you need to read it because it's all about what happens to Jacob's self-identity, okay, and how all it fits into what Paul's saying here. Okay, so Paul says, look, if you're a legalist, then the promise that was based on faith isn't yours. Because you're not doing it on the basis of trust, you're doing it on the basis of reward. Okay? Then he says, for the law brings about wrath. But it's not the law that brings about wrath. It's the legalist attitude toward rules, right? But where there is no law, isn't that interesting? Look at the translation. In the NASB, it says, for the law, and it capitalizes, meaning they want you to think that that means Torah. And then they said, for where there is no law, same word, but now they don't capitalize it because now they recognize that it has to be rules that the Gentiles live by because there's no law, right? Neither is there violation. In other words, we've said this over and over before. Weisengott got it right, right? Sin is a religious idea. It's not an ethical idea. Sin depends on a divine lawgiver. So if I work in a world where there's no divine lawgiver, I can't sin. I can still do what's morally unethical, but it isn't sin because it isn't judged in the same way because I am unaware of the divine lawgiver. Once I'm aware of the divine lawgiver, then Torah becomes the standard, right? So Paul's argument is, hey, wait a minute. We have people in the Gentile world whose attitude is the same as Abraham, and who God pays attention to because of that attitude, who live outside of the Torah community, right? Are we therefore to judge them as reprobate and outside the kingdom? And his answer would be no, because that's exactly the position Abraham was in. Abraham trusted in what he knew of God, and God recognized that as the basis for a character willing to obey, okay? So now he says, we go on. For this reason, it is by faith, this is from the NASB, that it might be in accordance with grace in order that the promise may be certain to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, and again, word nomos, remember, but also those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. So the NASB makes it look like there's a disparity between those of the law and those of faith. But clearly that's not the case, because what Paul is arguing is, if you're a legalist, good luck, right? But if you're willing to trust in God, no matter what your ethnicity or your background, God is willing to pay attention to you, right? That's his argument in a nutshell, right? Now he says, as it is written, a father of many nations have I made you. And Paul's argument is, how can God make Abraham the father of many nations if the only ones that he pays attention to are the Jews? It shouldn't say a father of many nations. It should say a father of the nation. And, of course, Paul's argument is Abraham was chosen before he fulfilled the the obligation of circumcision in the same way that Gentiles in the first century, when Paul writes the letter, are fulfilling the willingness, trusting in God, and coming into the Jewish assembly, the synagogue in Rome. And Paul is arguing, you can't exclude these people on the basis of the fact that they haven't been circumcised, because they are responding in the same way that Abraham did. Okay, Linda, you have a comment?
I'm just going to say that Stern's translation is better. And this yes. particular verse is, I have appointed you to be a father of many nations, rather than I've made, you know, the one that you read, which kind of makes a sense, because this is going to be in the future, or it's going to be, I mean, it's going to be in the future from this, actually, but you're right. Yes. And if you go back and you read, he is the father of many nations, many, many nations.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
The translation is better.
Yep. And you'll recognize when we did the study of, when we did the study of Nanos and Zetterholm. Well, we did this thing. Paul and Judaism Revisited. Remember? Nanos and Zetterholm. Oh, no, this is Sprinkled. There's another book.
Nanos.
Where is it? This is it. Yeah, this is it. Paul within Judaism. Okay, we did this study. It's recorded on... If you haven't heard this, you can go back and pick it up from this website, right? We did the study of all of these articles written by critical scholars on putting Paul into the Jewish context. And you remember one of the important arguments was that it is not possible to understand Paul if you think that the kingdom is only made up of Jews. And those who are proselytes to Jews, and those who become Jews because of their messianic affiliation. Paul's view is the kingdom is made up of Gentiles and Jews, but they all have a relationship with God. It's the relationship with God that makes the kingdom, not the religious affiliation. Okay? And you remember Fridrikson and Nanos all argue this point in that study. Okay? So if you're interested in how that develops, and where the critical scholarship is behind that idea, you can pick up that study. But it's exactly what Paul's saying here. Abraham is the father of multiple nations, right? Nations, goi.
And that's the promise that was given. But that's the promise that was given to him. I mean, you go back and you read the promise, yeah. You know, I'll make you. And I mean, and to Sarah. I mean, to both he and Sarah. But multiple, yes. Many nations. And all you have to, yeah.
Yeah, and you can see that's why Paul cites this verse, a father of many nations I have appointed you or made you, right? Because he wants to make sure that the Gentile population of the Roman synagogue doesn't think that somehow they're excluded because they haven't followed the legalistic rules, right? So to the Orthodox community, his argument is, wait a minute, Abraham was chosen by God and fulfilled the trust requirement to God before circumcision. And to the Gentile community in the same assembly, he's saying, okay, you have an opportunity to act as Abraham and come into the assembly. Once you've done that, then something else has to happen, and we're going to see how he develops that. But the entry pass isn't Torah. The entry pass is this idea of aman, trust. Okay? So, remember, it's a causative action. Okay, so now we go to 18. In hope against hope, he believed. He's talking about Abraham. In order that he might become a father of many nations, according to which it was spoken, you shall your descendants be, so shall your descendants be. Again, citing Genesis. So we got to go back over and over and over to understand what's happening in the Genesis passage in order to see what Paul's arguing. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead since he was about 100, and the deadness of Sarah's womb, and yet, with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving God the glory. Okay, so now what's Paul doing? He's saying, okay, look, we have a living example of what this trust means. It isn't just, you know, an inner spiritual attitude. In fact, it confronts actions in the real world. So the best example is Abraham. who believed that God will fulfill his commitment to him in spite of the fact that he was sexually impotent and Sarah was way past childbearing years. Okay? So believing God despite human assessment is the basis for the trust that initiates God's response to Abraham. Okay? And he's using this example to show in as graphic terms as possible how Abraham's trust preceded the fulfillment of any of the commandments. Okay? Therefore, he says, yet, with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief and grew strong in faith, giving God the glory, and being fully assured that what he, God, had promised, he was able to perform. Right? And then he cites again from the Tanakh, right? Therefore, also, it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Okay, same idea, same verse, and reckoned to him as righteousness, you can now see, means God paid attention to Abraham's trust and recognized that Abraham had the same character quality that God was looking for in himself, right? And therefore counted Abraham, right, as righteous. In other words, recognized that Abraham aligned himself with the expected standard, that is God's character. Okay? It's all tied together there. So at the end of this chapter, he said, therefore, now, not for his own sake only was it written. Oh, okay. So now we see Paul is saying, okay, something really important has happened here. The story of Abraham's faithfulness, his trust in God, isn't just a story for the Jewish community. And for our history as Orthodox Jews, it's also a story about what happens in the Gentile world when God pays attention to those people who exhibit God's character in their attitude and their willingness, right? That story, according to Paul, has universal application. Okay, what's the universal application? That the same kind of response that Abraham had can happen in the Gentile world, even though in the Gentile world, the Torah is as yet unknown. Because what matters is not the Torah, but the willingness to enter in to the character of God in my own life so that I have an expression of who God is inside me. And then when I encounter Torah, I accept it and commit myself to it. Okay? So he says, For our sake also, to whom it will be reckoned, as those who believe in him, okay, same word, remember, the word, now he's picking up the word from the Genesis account, right? To believe, aman, remember, we get the word amen from this, okay? So to those who believe in him, what kind of belief? A cognitive belief that I just say, okay, statement of faith, I check it all off? Think about this. If I enter the Christian church, and I commit myself to a statement of faith, have I really done what Paul says here about believing? Or have I just obligated God to respond in a certain kind of way because I've asserted these cognitive truths? Right? And my observation is that most people think that because I've become a member of a church, God is obligated to do things for me. I've been a good boy. And I joined the church and I've signed the statement of faith and I've made I said the sinner's prayer and I've asked for forgiveness and Jesus is in my heart and God is obligated to send me to heaven. Okay? That's the idea. And of course, that's Paul's view of legalism. That if I keep the rules, it means that God has to perform. And that's not what Paul's saying. What Paul's saying is believing is a causative action, but it's not a causative action that forces God to be obligated to anything. It's a causative action which causes God to pay attention to me. And the fact that he pays attention to me is based on his graciousness, not mine. I don't earn it. God is by nature gracious. And therefore, my willingness to align my character with his causes him to recognize me. Okay? Doesn't mean he's obligated to do anything. It means that what he does comes from his own inner character. Okay? And then he says in the last verse, those who believe in him And what do we believe about him, right? We believe, we trust in God, and it is this God who raised Yeshua our Lord from the dead. Okay, does that say anything about the divine status of Yeshua? No. It says that this God that we trust is the one who raised Yeshua from the dead. End of story. Doesn't tell us that Yeshua is the second person of the Trinity, doesn't have anything to do with theology, just basically the facts. And the fact is, the same God that we trust, who will pay attention to us and recognize our willingness to be like him, is the same God that raised the Messiah from the dead. Okay? So 25. This God, who was believed, with Jesus our Lord from the dead, him, that refers to the Messiah, who was delivered up because of our transgressions and was raised because of our justification. And raised because of our justification. Okay. So what is he doing there? We'll have to come back to this verse again when we have more time, but what he's doing is hinting at the idea that something significant happened in the resurrection that affects all Jews and Gentiles, and that is the establishment in human history of the presence of the kingdom and the initiation of the process by which the kingdom will eventually arrive in full. Okay? So, it isn't as though Jesus dies on the cross for our sins. He dies and is raised from the dead by God as a, just like circumcision, as a symbolic representation of the power of the kingdom of God and the anticipation that it will arrive. Yes, Lindy?
Can I just read the translation from Stern from 20?
Yeah, of course.
23. I got better eyes. I need better eyes. Okay, from 23 to 25. But the words, and in bold, it was credited to his account, were not written for him only. They were written also for us, who will certainly have our account credited too, T-O-O, also, because we have trusted in him who was raised, Yeshua our Lord from the dead. He was delivered over to death because of our offenses and raised to life in order to make us righteous. That's Stern's translation.
Okay.
Makes more sense.
With that translation, I would say that Stern has moved toward a Christian theology.
I agree.
Because you will notice that he accounts for the removal of our transgressions through the, look what he says in, when you're reading the last couple of verses. He treats this as though it is Jesus the Lord who caused the forgiveness, right?
Right. And this is one place where he did. I remember that he said it at one point in time, it's beyond time, that he would go back and retranslate. But you're right. That's where you can see that.
True. Yes, but read verse 24 again. Read verse 24 again and take enough time so that we can all hear exactly what it says. Because
here's I'm going to read 23 first. But the words in bold, it was credited to his account, meaning Abraham, I believe, were not written for him only. They were written also for us, who will certainly have our account credited also. Because we have trusted in him. That's where it is, right there. Because we have trusted in him who raised our Lord from the dead.
Yeah, but look how he finishes.
Yeah.
The next verse.
Yeshua was delivered over to death because of our offenses and raised to life because of our right, to make us righteous. And you're right. That's where he turns. I agree.
Yeah. And notice that he still uses the term credited as though what's really happening is the reconciliation of a bank account. Okay? Credited. Yeah. And what we've seen is that credited is only one of the umbrella of meanings that follow from the word logizomai in Greek And it could be read in other kinds of ways, like declared or proclaimed or concluded or decided, which doesn't have anything to do with a bank account, right? So I want to move away from the idea, the Lutheran Calvinistic approach, which says that God keeps a scorecard, and because of your faith, he adds extra points, right? That's not what Paul has in mind at all, because that certainly wasn't the case with Abraham. What Paul is arguing is Abraham's basic character trait, which was trust, causes God to pay attention to him, as Heschel says, to become known by him. And as a result of that, God recognizes a character in Abraham that reflects his own character. That's what it means to be human. And God treats him accordingly. That's what that we're talking about. It's not adding points to my balance account. Okay?
Yeah.
And more importantly, at the end of the chapter, it isn't Yeshua that causes this to happen. Yeshua is the physical, historical representation of God's faithfulness when it comes to the kingdom. Right? He shows us in the resurrection. I mean, Yeshua is the first fruits, and Paul even says that, right? He's the first fruits, which means that his resurrection is the symbolic representation and authority upon which we trust that God will treat us in the same way. But it's all about God. It's not about what Yeshua does.
You know, if you take the holidays of Passover, Feast of First Fruits, and Shavuot, okay, the Feast of First Fruits, which is really not celebrated much anywhere, really, what it is saying, if you bring your, it's like 3 days after, so it's the Shabbat after, so you bring your first wheat, I'm not a farmer, so the first thing that comes out of the ground, the wheat, yeah. And you bring it to the temple, and if it was accepted, and it was good, then the rest of the crop would be good, and this is what that is.
Yeah,
that's the only.
Yes.
That's how I see it. So, goes back to for me.
Yeah, we need to step back from the Christian idea that somehow Jesus is the one who forgives your sin. Okay. Yeah, now it's true that in the role of the Messiah, he acts as God's agent on behalf of God to forgive sin, because he says that he can do that. And it basically, the man lowered through the roof, right? The rabbis object, only God can forgive sin. What does he say? He says, the Son of Man has been given authority. That doesn't mean he has it in himself. He acts as God's agent, and therefore he has the right to forgive on God's behalf. But that's
right,
very different than saying I can forgive, right? And so we need to step away from the idea that somehow Jesus forgives our sin. No, God forgives the sin, and the Tanakh is very clear about that. But Yeshua is the agent by which that happens in the messianic revelation, right? And the way that God works is through this man to provide the rest of humanity, including the Gentiles, hopefully, a symbolic representation of what God is able to do now and in the future, right?
Yeah, I agree.
I listened to a lecture last night for a couple of hours, and it was about the Book of Enoch. But there was a really, really important point made on the first couple of verses of John, the prologue, where so many Trinitarians find their basis for claiming that Jesus is God and therefore he can actually forgive our sins. And the point was made that the word in Greek is monogenesis, and it doesn't mean only begotten. It means one of a kind. Awesome. So Yeshua is one of a kind. And I mean, there's only one Messiah and he's it, right? But that doesn't mean that he is a begotten son in the divine sense. Monogenesis is a different word than what would be used for someone who is of equal status. Okay? So again, Paul is right in line with Jewish orthodoxy. He's just trying to get Jewish orthodoxy to open its mind to the fact that Gentiles who come with the same arrangement that Abraham had are also equal members of the community, right? That they have just as much right as the Orthodox Jews to be in the assembly because their faith is based on the same thing, That is trust in God's benevolence. Okay.
So Skip, even though they were all in this assembly together, the Orthodox Jews in that assembly with them were still hesitant to just accept them, accept everyone coming in. They were still putting up roadblocks for them. Is that why Paul was having to do that?
Yeah. Now, okay, so we don't know that Paul knows that specifically, because Paul didn't have any interaction with the Romans. He hadn't been there yet. But it's the same issue that he faced in Galatians, the same issue he faced in Ephesians, the same issue that was going on in Thessalonica, and it was exactly the same issue that's the subject matter of the Acts 15 council, right? The issue is, what do we do with the Gentiles? They're not Jews, right?
So he's kind of assuming that that's happening there too.
Probably, because it was so much a problem throughout the Mediterranean world wherever he went that he's anticipating that the same thing will be happening in Rome. Or maybe he heard via the grapevine that it was happening in Rome. But the issue isn't just Roman. The whole book, the whole letter to the Galatians is about that problem, right? And so here he's saying one more time, don't you realize that in Galatians, they're called the Judaizers, that the Jewish legalists were putting up a roadblock to the Gentiles and preventing them from being full members of the assembly because they hadn't gone through the proper legalist rituals. And Paul's argument is legalism has nothing to do with this, right? The basis of the faith is the same faith that Abraham had. It's this trusting in God's benevolence. Once that occurs, then you start learning Torah. But Torah comes afterwards, not before.
So in a sense, the difference is, in regards to what Paul's saying, is the Christian church basically took everything Paul said about letting people in, but then disregarded learning Torah and going on with, you know, that. So they just took one part and then they
exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's why they translate these words nomos as the law with the capital L. Because what they've done is they've said, okay, well, Paul obviously lets people in who have not yet embraced Torah. Therefore, Torah can't have anything to do with faith. But that's not exactly that's not what Paul's saying at all. What Paul's saying is that the initiation into the community occurs before the Torah because it's built on willingness. It's built on trust. But once trust is established, look, it's chesed, right? Once the relationship is established, then the IOU follows. Right? And the Christian church just basically severed the two. So it said, you see, Paul says works has nothing to do with faith, therefore we don't have anything to do after we're believers, we're secure. Right? And that isn't Paul's argument at all. Okay,
Skip.
Robin, you have a comment?
I'm not disagreeing with you, brother, but do you realize the explosive nature of your statement, Jesus doesn't forgive sins?
Yeah, of course I realized that. I wrote a book about it. Right? No, actually, Jesus does forgive sins as the agent of God, but not in and of himself, right?
Yeah.
So the point is, I mean, I'm not going to say he doesn't forgive sins because he obviously does forgive sins. He forgives all kinds of people as he goes through his ministry. But he does it as an agent. He does it on behalf of the one who is actually the forgiver, that is God. Okay? Yeah. And so when I wrote the book Crossword Puzzles, it's all about that idea. I mean, I remember when I first gave that lecture, I was standing in a church and behind me was a banner on the wall. And it said, for God so loved the world that he gave Jesus to die for our sins. And I said, wait a minute, that's not what the verse says, right? But that's what everybody thinks, that God sent Jesus to forgive us for our sins, because that's what the evangelical world preaches. But it's not scriptural, and it's certainly theologically biased, right? Because the fact of the matter is, God is the forgiver, and his Messiah is simply an agent to do that.
not only that, man, and it's in Torah that man, that a person can't die, sacrifice themselves for someone else's sin. You can't. I mean, it's
yeah. That's
why he exactly. That's why he couldn't even be a man. He would have to be a god because a man cannot do that.
Yes, you know, the interesting thing about that is, if as a man he represents an agent of God, a monogenesis, a one time only, right, a one of a kind agent, and he acts on God's behalf, so he can say, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father," right? That means that what he shows us in terms of forgiveness is the way God thinks about forgiveness. But it's God who does the forgiving. So Yeshua doesn't die for you and me. He dies to fulfill a commitment to God as the agent of God to demonstrate God's faithfulness and forgiveness. God's faithfulness.
Puts a whole different perspective on things, doesn't it?
Yes. And I don't want to get too far sidetracked on that. We can do another book sometime. But in terms of this letter, you can see Paul's argument. Paul's argument is, look, you, the Orthodox community, all accept Abraham as the father of faith, but notice what happens with Abraham. And the same thing is happening with the Gentiles who are coming into your assembly. So open your arms to them as you would to Abraham. Recognize that what's happened to them is prior to their to the receipt of the Torah. And now let's go to work on fulfilling the obligation to God that we have as a result of God's benevolence toward us. Chesed. Okay? Tim, one more comment?
Yeah. So it seems like what Paul is doing is trying to get the Jewish community, especially the leaders, to look back at least to me, to look back at Sinai and said, remember when they said, we will do and then listen. As far as
they said, we will do and we will hear. In one case, it's we will do and we will hear. In the other case, it's we'll hear and we will do. Okay. So same event, seen from two different perspectives. And yeah, Paul is trying to say, okay, look, we are going to talk about Torah and the obligation to meet God's expectation because that's what dikeusine is, righteousness, right? Tzedekah is to conform to an expectation. Okay. So that we're going to talk about that. But the first thing that we have to establish, and this is what he's doing right here is the first thing we have to establish is that both groups have equal access. The Gentiles and the Jews don't come on different footing. They both have the same access. Now we go forward in unity to see what that means. Okay?
Skip, I have a couple quick observations. I have a couple quick observations you may or may not find relevant. First, I would say that there are cases where God makes himself aware to people in the Bible and they choose to not trust him. The Pharaoh in the time of Joseph is a good example. Right. So yeah. it isn't like every time God presents himself to a human, they necessarily trust him. It is their choice. Right. And Abraham chooses to trust.
Yes.
Him. And then the second observation is this is very similar to the story of Noah. Right. In that time. So just a couple.
Yeah. That's a good point that Noah is a good example because Noah trusted God. By the way, it says and God found favor in Noah's right with Noah. And what did he trust? He trusted that God's promise would be fulfilled. And the whole community around him is saying, no, it's not going to happen. They didn't pay any attention at all. So it's the same idea. Good point, Larry. Okay, anything more before we close for this week? No? You have plenty to think about. Now, somebody asked me if I would put those two, you know, the four pages that I read at the beginning, this stuff. Somebody asked me if I would put those in the extra material. Guess what? It's scheduled to be in today's Word, okay? But you're going to have to wait a while. It's a month from now. So if you want me to put it in the extra material, I will. But you're going to end up reading it again on the 28th of February, okay? Because I'm writing way ahead. So, okay. So there you go.
Yes, please put it in the extra materials. I don't want to wait. I want to read it before I don't want to wait a month.
Okay. Okay. I will see you guys next week. Have a blessed week, and think hard about all this stuff. And then we start on chapter 5, which is another nice, long, complicated argument. Okay.
Bye-bye.
See ya. Ciao.